The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, somehow we're already at the philosophy of language analysis, and I want to spend more time on this because this is certainly the philosophy that has dominated British and American universities in the 20th century. Now, there's some tendency nowadays to get away from this. Even in Britain and America, there's much more emphasis on such things as Marxism, and outside of philosophy departments, you have something called structuralism, which is a type of language philosophy in a way, but it's proceeding in rather different directions from the type of language philosophy that I'll be describing in these lectures. So there is some tendency away from this movement, but on the other hand, there's still a great deal of emphasis upon it, and in a way, it's just beginning to have a real impact upon theology and upon the Christian church. So I think we ought to be aware of what's going on in this type of thinking, and I'm going to be spending more time on this than I have on other matters, for one thing, because I've prepared these lectures a little better, having given them in past years than I've given some of the other than I've prepared some of the other material, and this is a particular interest of mine. So I'm going to be, I figure I can be most helpful to you on things that I'm interested in. So here we go on these the philosophy, a group of philosophies that put together can be described as language analysis. Now, through most of the 20th century, the main division among philosophers has widely been thought to be the English Channel. That's not quite accurate, but that's a generalization that sets you on the right track. In Britain and America, most philosophers have practiced language analysis in some form, while on the continent of Europe, most philosophers have practiced some form of phenomenology or existentialism. Now, of course, there are exceptions to this. There's quite a bit of language analysis being done in the Scandinavian countries. Logical positivism got its start in Vienna. There's a certain amount of phenomenology and existentialism going on in this country. But it is true to say generally that in Britain and America, the major philosophical schools fall into the category of language analysis. If you try to compare language analysis with existentialism, and these have been the two major movements, I think, in the 20th century philosophically, if you try to compare the two, they seem to be very different at first glance. Language analysis appears to seek clarity with a great passion, whereas existentialism and phenomenology seem to avoid clarity with equal passion. Language analysis, on the other hand, is criticized because language analysts seem to be constantly preoccupied with trivial things, analyzing the language we use to describe the aroma of coffee or the possibility of knowing somebody else's toothache and questions of that kind. But seem to be worthy only of OP presbyteries and so on. Existentialism, on the other hand, seems to be preoccupied with the great life and death issues of our situation: despair, death, dread, anxiety, and so on. So the traditional criticism, the traditional comparison that's made is that language analysis is very clear, very precise about very trivial matters, whereas existentialism is hopelessly muddled and unclear about very important matters. That is sort of the caricature of the two movements that you often hear. But you've heard Dr. Knudsen on existentialism, and now you're going to hear me on language analysis. And I hope that in the course of these lectures, you'll come to see, among other things, how much alike these two types of thinking really are beneath all the surface dissimilarity, beneath all the apparent dissimilarities. Now, one obvious similarity between these two types of thinking is that both of them have a profound concern for language. Both of them have a profound concern for language. Both Heidegger, the existentialist, and Wittgenstein, the language analyst, believe that the study of language is the key to philosophy. Now, Heidegger typically expresses this conviction in the sort of metaphorical language. He says that language is the house of being. Wittgenstein never said anything quite as spooky as that. But he clearly thought that language was an important way of getting into philosophical issues. And I think you can make that generalization about 20th century philosophy. It's not a generalization that carries out in all instances, but generally you have to say 20th century philosophy is linguistically oriented. So before we say anything about any specific philosophers, I think it's important for us to make a few introductory remarks about language philosophy generally, language philosophy as a phenomenon. What do we mean when we talk about language philosophy? Why is it that 20th century philosophers typically try to get to the philosophical problems by means of language? Well, in one sense, philosophers have always been interested in language. Thomas Aquinas, you remember, was concerned about the differences between univocal language, equivocal language, and analogical language, the different kinds of literal and figurative expressions that we use, particularly in referring to God. And Thomas Aquinas's concern with language can be traced back to Aristotle. So philosophers have always been interested in how language works and the meaning of language in the way that language refers to the world. Now, that is the philosophy of language. How is it that language works? How is it that language gets attached to things? How is it that language gets involved in our lives? But now, in the 20th century, a somewhat different kind of interest in language has come to the fore. Because in the 20th century, the thought has occurred to many people that a study of language might be useful not only to teach us something about language, but also to help us solve many of the continuing philosophical disputes. All right? A study of language to help us solve not only problems about language, but problems in all the other areas of philosophy as well. And so in the 20th century, we have not only philosophy of language, we have language philosophy. We are studying language not just to learn about language, but to solve many problems in other areas. For instance, the problems of metaphysics. What is the world really like in its most basic features? Is the world one or many? Is it changing or changeless? Is it mind or matter? Problems of epistemology, theory of knowledge. How do we know? By sense or by reason? By a combination of the two? What's the relation between the two? And so on. What's the final criterion of truth and of validity in reasoning? What about theory of value, of which ethics is the most important part? Questions of our obligation. What is right? What is wrong? Well, all of these questions are discussed in our time by an appeal to the nature of language. Now, why is it that these philosophers are turning to language to answer problems of this kind? Well, there are many reasons, but let me point out two of them to you. First, a fairly simple reason, this will be A on the board, and then a fairly complex and technical reason, which is B on the board. First, the simple reason. Most of these disputes in philosophy, metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics, most of these disputes have been going on for hundreds of years and even for thousands of years, and they haven't been getting anywhere. Now, that's strange. You see, on most matters of knowledge, it's pretty easy to get agreement, isn't it? It used to be that there were some people who thought that the world was flat until somebody sailed around it, and when somebody sailed around it, well, pretty quickly, everybody was convinced that the world was not flat, it was round. Now, of course, there's still a flat earth society in Great Britain. I don't know if they take themselves too seriously, but they, yes. Also in Austin, Texas. Well, I suppose in Texas it's easier to believe that the earth is flat. But anyway, it's nice to know that there are some people to the right of Westminster. Anyway, you... With regard to some issues, I almost said the OPC, but I couldn't cut them down twice in one lecture. on some issues, it almost seems that once you get the facts, you can publish those facts and people will be convinced. But there are other questions that aren't like that. Philosophical questions are not like that. Philosophers have been discussing basically the same questions since Plato, since Thales, since the very beginning of philosophy. And these learned men, very intelligent men, well-educated men, experts in philosophy, they debate these issues on and on and on, over and over again. They never seem to get any agreement among themselves. Now, what do you do when something like that happens? Or what should you do when something like that happens? Well, what do you do? And you've got two intelligent people arguing. They both seem to be aware of the facts, but they can't seem to agree. Well, maybe the problem is that they don't understand one another. And maybe the problem is that they're talking past one another, that there's a failure of communication. So you begin to pay attention to the language. You begin to ask each party to define his terms. You ask this man, what do you mean by change? And ask this fellow, what do you mean by changelessness? What do you mean by time? What do you mean by mind? What do you mean by matter? And so the simple reason then why people are preoccupied with language today is fairly simple. It's just that philosophers have gotten tired of talking past one another. And they want to go back to the fundamentals, in a sense. They want to get back to defining these basic terms, clarifying the questions that are being asked with the hope that maybe, having done that, we can make some progress. Now, certainly, there's a lot to be said for that idea. It's refreshing to have people going back to basics in that kind of way. In fact, it seems to me that that's the kind of thing that ought to be done more often in theology. The trouble is, however, that after 75 years or so of language philosophy, we still haven't achieved very much success. We're still debating these same issues, even though we've been clarifying the questions for 75 years or so. And why is it then that we're still talking past one another, no matter how much we try to clarify the terms and so on? Well, the reason is that they still have not faced up to the differences in presuppositions, you see. They still are, each one is coming at it with a somewhat different presuppositional structure, and they're not willing to admit their biases in considering the meanings of language, and so they disagree with one another on what the language ought to mean, and there's further confusion then in the language that we use to discuss the language, and before you know it, we're back to the old routine again. Well, okay, so that's the simple reason then why the 20th century has turned to language philosophy. The second reason is a little bit more sophisticated, and that is that a number of people have felt in our time that language is a kind of gateway to reality. That language is a kind of gateway to reality. Now, that's true both in continental existentialism and also in British and American analysis, although this type of thing is more obviously and explicitly stated among the continental existentialists than among the American language philosophers. But even the British and Americans, I think, generally would accept this principle, that language is a kind of gateway to reality. Now, think about traditional philosophy for a minute, and I'll try to explain this. Think about metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics. The three disciplines, of course, are interrelated. If you start off with metaphysics, if you start off by trying to describe the world in which we live, to try to describe reality in its most basic structure, you must at the same time also describe the the structures of your mind. You must at the same time describe ways in which the mind functions. And so metaphysics leads you on to epistemology. And further, you'll have to confront your own values when you do metaphysics. You'll have to determine what the, among other things in this world, of course, there are values. Among other things in this world, if you're going to describe the world, you're going to have to use value-laden terms like good and bad and so on, so that this is going to lead you then into ethics. So you can start at any place, and if you start at metaphysics, you'll be led on to the other disciplines. If you start with epistemology, well, in order to know how you have to know how your mind fits into the world in general. Epistemology leads you on to metaphysics, and I don't have to go through all that routine. I think you can see how all three divisions are interrelated. Now, the history of philosophy, I guess, basically starts with metaphysics. Thales says that all is water. Anaximenes says that all is air. Anaximander says that all is apeiron, the indefinite. Now, the next step in philosophy is to ask, now, wait a minute here. How do we even think about knowing these things? How do we even go about deciding whether all is water or all is air or what? And this is, of course, a step that was taken by Parmenides and by Plato and by others to focus in on the theory of knowledge as a kind of gateway to metaphysics. Focus in on the theory of knowledge as a way to find out what the world is really like. We've already seen Parmenides, of course. Parmenides says that whatever is must be thought, and whatever can be thought consistently must be. So Parmenides believed that there was a one-to-one correlation between thought and reality. If you know what can be thought, you know what can be. So in Parmenides, then, epistemology is a gateway to metaphysics. You focus in on theory of knowledge, and once you understand what can be known, what can be thought, then you know what is. You can move from the one to the other. Now, of course, there are others then, particularly in later Greek thought, who start with ethics. They begin by asking, what are my obligations? And some of my obligations are epistemological in character. We've already discussed that. When you're confronted with a raft of data, what ought you to conclude? What is your ethical responsibility to that data? How should you treat it? How should you handle it? And so they begin with ethics and then move from ethics into epistemology, and from ethics and epistemology then into metaphysics. So you can start from either one of those three points. It's a kind of circle. And this is developed, of course, through the history of philosophy, different philosophers trying to find a single starting point by which they can sort of get into all the problems of philosophy. Now, 20th century philosophy, as I understand it, claims to have found a new focus, a new way of getting into the problems of philosophy, namely the focus of language. Now, the key to metaphysics, the key to epistemology, the key to ethics is to discover what may be said. You remember how Hegel said the real is the rational, and the rational is the real. That's a way of making epistemology basic. That's a way of saying, if you want to know what's real, find out what can be known. If you want to find out what's real, find out how the mind works. Well, I think today, in the contemporary philosophy, the proper slogan would have to be, the real is the sayable. The real is what can be said. And the sayable is the real. Whatever can be spoken of must in some sense be. Now that slogan fits some language philosophers better than others, and we'll have to make some modifications along the line. But there is that, I think, that general type of reasoning working through all language philosophy. Now, in a way, that's a pretty good insight, right? You really can't claim that something is real unless you can talk about it, right? You can't claim that something is real unless you can talk about it. If you say anything that's real, that thing must be expressible in language somehow. Just as the older philosophers said, anything you say is real must be thinkable, must be conceivable. Well, the same thing can be true sayability. What we define as real must be sayable, must be expressible in our language. And so this is a way of metaphysics to find out what can be said in the language. And that leads you then to the real, to the knowable, and to the realm of obligation. So it gets you into metaphysics, into epistemology, and into ethics. If it cannot be spoken of, if something cannot be spoken of, then certainly you cannot say that it exists, right? Something cannot be spoken of, we faced this with Immanuel Kant in a little different connection a while ago. If you don't know something exists, what right do you have even to talk about it? What right do you have to make assertions about it? Well, you can't say that something is real unless you can talk about it. And if something cannot be spoken of, then it can't exist. You can't say that it exists. If it can be spoken of, then it has some kind of reality. It has some, you know, anything that you speak of, even speaking of unicorns, even speaking of fictions and imaginary things, anything that you can speak of has some kind of reality. Maybe it's only a mental reality. Maybe it's only a reality of concept, but nevertheless, it has some reality, and it has to be taken account of in a full view of the world. Now, there's nothing terribly new about all this. If you look back at Plato's dialogues, you'll find out that when Plato's characters ask the really big questions, questions like, what is justice, they tend to resolve those questions by speaking about language, by speaking concerning the use of terms. Socrates asks somebody, what is justice? Well, how do they resolve it? They don't go around, set up a caravan and go from one city to another observing courts or observing judgments in different situations and trying to come to generalizations on a quasi-scientific basis. No, they don't do any experiments. They don't take any surveys. They don't take any Gallup polls. What do? Well, they examine the language that they use. If something or other were to happen, would you call that just? Would you apply the term justice to this procedure? If somebody behaves in this way, do you call that just? Somebody behaves in this other way, would you call that unjust? Just how does the word justice function in our language? In what situations do we use the term justice? How do we speak about justice? And once you find out how the word justice is used, then you know what justice is, don't you? At least that seems to be the kind of argument that underlies a number of the Platonic dialogues. Aristotle does the same thing. He develops his metaphysics by observing certain relationships between subjects and predicates in sentences, and developing his view of the world as kind of parallel to the structure of language as he understands it. Now, all philosophers have solved philosophical problems by reference to linguistic usage. But the thing about the 20th century philosophers is that now they're doing it self-consciously. Now they're using this as a self-conscious method. And they really believe, whether Plato would have said this or not, I don't know. I don't know of any place where Plato would have said this, but you find this all over 20th century philosophy. If we really understand how language works, we know how the world works too. Now, since you've already had some lectures on existentialism, I'm going to confine myself right now to 20th century British and American philosophy. And we have actually three different kinds of movements that are can be described as language philosophies in one sense or other. The three of them are logical atomism. That's the first. The others would be here's the next transparency that you'll see in a moment. The others would be logical positivism and then ordinary language philosophy. So we're going to take those in order. Now, first, logical atomism. By the way, there's bibliography for all of these things in your study guide. Logical atomism is exemplified in Bertrand Russell's article by the same title, and also in Wittgenstein's early work, particularly the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. Now, let's try to put this in a bit of context. We've seen that in 19th century philosophy, you have, of course, the great legacy of Immanuel Kant being worked out in all kinds of different forms. You have a rejuvenation of rationalism among the Hegelian idealists. You have a rejuvenation of empiricism under John Stuart Mill. And then you have an attempt to find a synthesis, again, between these two tendencies in the writings of the realists, people such as Reed, Hamilton, and so on. I mentioned them to you earlier. Most British philosophy in the late 19th century was idealist. As I mentioned, Hegelian idealism had performed a very great feat, namely to jump across the English Channel. And so in Great Britain, in the late 19th century, the main thinkers were T.H. Green, F.H. Bradley, and later on Bernard Bosanquet, getting into the 20th century, who were the dominant thinkers in British philosophy. And they were idealists. They moved in the tradition of Hegel. Now, Bertrand Russell is probably the most formative figure in the early stages of language analysis. Russell has a very mixed background. He comes from a family where there was quite a bit of political and other attachment to the ideas of John Stuart Mill, quite a bit of the English empirical tradition sort of filtered around in Russell's environment. When Russell first emerged from his philosophical training, he came out as an idealist. Tells a story about how he walked into a tobacco shop once, and he put the tobacco in his pipe and lit it, and then he walked out of the shop, and all of a sudden he jumped up, and the pipe flew out of his hands and went up in the air, and the tobacco fell all over, and there were ashes and so on and so forth, and he exclaimed, "The ontological argument is sound." Well, by George, or whatever it was. Anyway, that evidently marked Russell's initiation as an idealist, you see, coming around from his general empiricism to an idealist position. However, Russell also reports, as only Russell can report about himself, that having been an idealist, he was an idealist until he actually sat down and read Hegel, and then when he read Hegel, he discovered that it was all nonsense. And before then, of course, he thought that Hegel must have said something terribly profound, but having actually read Hegel, he decided that it was all nonsense and didn't want anything more to do with it. Then for a while, Russell was a disciple of Meinong and the realist tradition. And then around the early 1900s, he began to work on a new system of logic. And his colleague was a man named Alfred North Whitehead, that we'll hear about later on. Whitehead moved in an entirely different direction from Russell. Whitehead became the father of process philosophy. You've been reading a little bit about process theology in your reading for this week. Russell and Whitehead worked together on a book called The Principia Mathematica, the Mathematical Principles. This was a real milestone in the history of mathematics and the history of logic. solved a number of paradoxes that were insoluble in terms of previous logical systems. It presented a very rich apparatus for the resolving of logical questions. It attempted to derive mathematics from logic, or to show that both mathematics and logic can be seen as part of the same system, and that's still being debated now, but Russell thought that he had achieved that, and a lot of others thought that he had too. Well, to get into that would be terribly technical, but to make a long story short, Russell thought that this new system of logic could be made the basis of a new metaphysic. It could be made the basis for a new philosophy. This logic was rich, it was successful in solving problems, and all of this would suggest, or at least it suggested to Bertrand Russell, that somehow this system of logic reflected the structure of the world, Now here you can find echoes of idealism and also echoes of realism, both of them maintaining that as you study the structure of your ideas, you come to understand something of the structure of the world. So it was very natural for Russell to think in those terms. Now, how do you get from a system of logic to a metaphysics? How do you get from a system of logic to a view of the world? Well, the connecting link is language. The idea is that the through Russell's logic, we can clarify human language. We can refine that language so that it becomes an actual picture of reality, so that every element of language will correspond to an element in the real world, so that every element of language will refer to something in the real world. Now, here you have echoes of realism again, with its emphasis on the emphasis on referring, that every idea has a reference beyond itself. You also have an empiricist element in this new philosophy, in that the reference between the language and the world, you see here you have the language, here you have the world, how do you tie the language to the world? Basically through sense data, through experience formulated into sense data. You have a sense datum of a particular object, and you connect the word in the language with that sense datum. I have a sense datum of a chair, and I connect the word chair with that sense datum. I make sure that those are firmly attached to one another, and then I make my ideas, that way I make my ideas clear. So there is quite a bit of emphasis on sense experience, which comes out of traditional empiricism. Now, the classical exposition of this logical atomist position is found not in the writings of Russell, but in a book called the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which is there on the board, by Russell's most brilliant pupil, a man named Ludwig Wittgenstein. Now, I want to say a little bit about Wittgenstein. He's a fascinating character, and he may turn out to be the most important philosopher of the 20th century. Maybe not. I'm a little bit less sure of myself on that than I was a few years ago. But Wittgenstein is one of the most interesting philosophical biographies, one of the most interesting. You think of a number that are interesting, like Kierkegaard and so on, but I would put Wittgenstein's up there with the rest of them. Wittgenstein was born in Vienna, Austria, to a very wealthy family. It was a Jewish family that was nominally converted to Roman Catholicism, which was fairly common at that period. Wittgenstein had three brothers. They all had four brothers. Three of them committed suicide. The fourth brother, Paul Wittgenstein, was a concert pianist who made a very promising debut and then lost his right arm in the war. He did go on to, even with one hand, he became a very well-known concert pianist. Some of you may be familiar with Ravel's Concerto for the Left Hand. That was written for Paul Wittgenstein. Ludwig, the philosopher, himself often thought about suicide. The tragedy, of course, all around him, both in his family and in the war. He did fight in the war, the First World War. All of this tragedy around him filled him with a great sense of despair about the world. Even more than that, he sensed his own inadequacies to cope, and he came to dislike himself very much. He came to dislike his academic environment. He came to dislike the world. And one senses in the biography of Wittgenstein a genuine religious quest. A number of points, he just got fed up with the life he was living altogether, and he left the teaching profession and disappeared, only to return again to a later day. Wittgenstein was a man who lived and thought very intensively. He had a great passion for really getting at the substance of a matter. He really wanted to get clear on his ideas. He felt that so many philosophers and so many academics generally were just playing games with words and with ideas. And Wittgenstein wanted to really get to the bottom of these questions. He wanted to develop a method where you could really resolve these issues that have been debated around back and forth for so many years. He was profoundly concerned that philosophy should not be just an academic parlor game to amuse people, but it ought to get to the very basis of truth and of life. Now, Wittgenstein's first book, and the only book that he published, first of all, a little background on his academic life. He started off as an engineer, and he came into philosophy by way of mathematics. He moved from engineering to mathematics, and then he was concerned about finding what were then known as the foundations of mathematics, what we'd probably call today the philosophy of mathematics. And that brought him to Bertrand Russell, and he came up to Bertrand Russell one day and asked Russell whether Russell thought he was a complete idiot or not. And Russell said, "Well, my dear man, I don't know whether you're a complete idiot or not." And Wittgenstein said, "Well, if I'm a complete idiot, I want to become an engineer. But if I'm not a complete idiot, I'd like to become a philosopher." And so Russell said, "Well, you write me something and bring it to me, and I'll read it, and I'll tell you whether you're a complete idiot or not." Well, Wittgenstein went off, and he came back and wrote something and gave it to Russell, and Russell read the first sentence and said, my friend, you must not become an engineer." The story indicates something of Wittgenstein's precociousness. He studied philosophy only about 2 years under Russell before we are told he began to influence Russell about as much as Russell influenced him. It's sort of a parallel between Poitras and Frame, you might say. Okay, then you have the all right, now the tract now you have the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which again is the only book that Wittgenstein published in his career. It's a book which covers almost all philosophical subjects. It has a fairly complex system of organization, which I won't bother you with here. But basically, in the Tractatus, Wittgenstein argues what has been called a picture theory of language, a picture theory of language. He maintains that we ought to, if we're going to become clear on our ideas and if we're going to achieve something in philosophy, we really have to purify our language by the application of Bertrand Russell's logic, Bertrand Russell's Principia Mathematica. And if we apply those principles, and Wittgenstein modifies them at points, but basically he accepts Russell's principles there, if we apply those principles, then we will discover a language where every sentence will correspond to a certain fact in the world. Here you have the realm of facts. Here you have the sentences, all right? Here are the facts of the world. Here are the sentences in the world. And once you get your language pure, said Wittgenstein, you'll have this kind of structure. Here are all the facts in the world. Each sentence in your language will correspond, will refer to one particular fact in the world. This sentence will correspond to this fact. Sentence two will correspond to fact number two. Sentence three will correspond to fact number three, and so on and so forth. So you'll have a perfect correspondence between the world and language. Wittgenstein was willing to analyze the facts down to smaller components. He argued that each fact consists of things, properties, or relations put together in some combination. That is, a fact would be, for instance, the fact that the book is on the table. Here you have two things, the book and the table, and they are united by a relationship, the relationship of the one being on the other. So you have two things and one relationship. That fact consists of two things and a relation. Okay? You have other facts that don't mention relationships at all. There are facts, for instance, where a property is attached to a thing. The book is green. Well, there's a fact that has a thing and a property. So you always have at least two of these elements. You always have at least you always have a thing, and then you have a property attached to it, or perhaps you have two or more things, and you have a relationship between those things expressed. Well, that's the nature of facts. Facts are things, properties, and relations combined in those sorts of ways. Now, in the perfect language, you see, the sentence will correspond with a fact. Each word will correspond to one element of a fact, all right? A fact consists, let's say your fact consists of two things and a relation. Well, then you'll have three words in your sentence. You'll have a word referring to the first thing, you'll have a word referring to the second thing, and then you'll have a third word referring to the relation. So that each element of the sentence then will refer to an element of the fact. So thereby, by these two devices, you see, connecting sentences with facts, connecting words with elements of facts, that way, Wittgenstein thought, your language would become a perfect picture of the world, a perfect picture of the world. Now, this is not as easy as it sounds. It's not terribly easy to purify your language that way, because if you're going to purify it, you have to reconstruct it considerably. Now, in terms of Bertrand Russell's logic, you have to distinguish between complex assertions and simple assertions. A complex assertion would be, for instance, a sentence combined with many conjunctions, like I got on a plane and I went to England and I got out and I did this and that, you know, like the law of consecutive in the Old Testament. This happened and that happened and so on. Well, that's you get that way. You get a long, complex sentence. Now, in Russell's logic, in order to determine the truth value of that long, complex sentence, in order to find out whether that sentence is true, you have to analyze it down into its components, into its simple components. So you take that long sentence and you break it up, decide, okay, what about the simple sentence, I got on the plane, is that true? And what about the simple sentence, I flew to London, and the simple sentence, I got off? And you'll calculate the truth value of the complex sentence on the basis of the truth value of the simple sentences. And if there's any falsity, of course, if any of the simple components are false, then the whole complex is false. If all of them are true, then the complex is true. So there are various ways in which you can calculate the truth value of the complexity on the basis of the truth value of the simples. Now, all right, that sounds pretty straightforward, but it turns out that for Russell, many of the sentences that seem to be simple are really complex. Many of the concepts that seem to be simple have to be reduced to even more simple concepts. For instance, take the sentence, England declared war. England declared war. Now, Russell argued that that sentence appears to be simple, but it's really complex because it really denotes a great many different things that happen. What does it mean for England to declare war? Well, it means that the Parliament did this, and the Prime Minister did this, and the generals did this, and the so on and so forth. There's a whole complex of activity. And if you really want to understand the truth value, then, of that sentence, England declared war, you have to break it down into its simple components and understand the truth value of those simple components. Ultimately, you have to know what all the members of Parliament did. And you have to know what the Prime Minister did. And you have to know went on in the military and the planning and so on and so forth. You have to break it down into its simple components. Well, not only a statement like that, but even take a statement like the book is on the table. Now, that sounds like a very simple statement, but in a way, it's a very complex statement. Because here you are, you're looking at that book, and you, now remember, these are empiricists talking. You look at this book and you see a certain shape there, right? Maybe you're looking at it from this angle and you see a shape just like that, you see. Well, all right, I register that impression. I have that sense impression. I have that sense datum. Then at another point, I'll see that, you see. And at another point, I'll see that. And eventually, I put them all together and I form the concept book. So on the basis of many experiences of seeing these shapes and different relationships to one another. I form the concept of book by putting them together, okay? And so to say the book is on the table is to register a great many experiences that you've had. Same thing with the table, you see. And same thing with the relation on. The relationship on is an idea that you form on the basis of many past experiences. And so to say that the book is on the table is to register a great many facts that have occurred to you, to register a great many experiences that have come into your mind, and to sort of add them all up in order to make that statement. Ultimately, said Russell, the only and Wittgenstein here, the only really simple concepts that we have are concepts like red patch now, okay? In other words, you see this color in front of you, and that's really simple, you see? And everything else is kind of built out of those momentary impressions that you get. All the whole complex of knowledge is built out of those things. And in order to then really get your language down to its simple components, you have to get it down to those statements of instantaneous sense impressions. You have to reduce statements about books to statements about blue sensations, and statements about hard sensations, and statements about various sensations associated with books. And that's the way you get down to a perfectly simple language, a perfectly simple world to which the perfect language may correspond perfectly. Now, this is why the system is called logical atomism, all right? Logic, because there's such a dependence upon Bertrand Russell's logical system. Atomistic, because you're breaking things down into their components. Remember, we've been contrasting atomism with monism. There's two different ways of resolving philosophical questions. The monist, trying to see everything in context, trying to see everything as related to everything else. The atomist, trying to break things down into their simple components and to understand the concept that way. Well, this is very definitely a species of atomism, but it's not the same kind of thing that you have in the Lucretius or Epicurus. It's not the dividing things into physical atoms, but it's dividing facts into atomic facts and dividing sentences into atomic sentences. And that terminology, of course, was used in this type of philosophy. Well, let's say a few things about some of the consequences of this type of thinking. First, with regard to epistemology, the knowable is what can be said, what can be coherently stated within the perfect language. In other words, If any item of fact is to be knowable, it must either be a simple fact, it must either be an atomic fact, or it must be capable of being reduced to atomic fact. And those two alternatives, if you're going to claim to know anything, you base that claim on the fact that either the claim is an atomic impression, or it can be reduced to such atomic impressions. So anything that you cannot reduce to sense experience, to momentary sense data, that is not to be accepted. Now, by the way, here is a little intramural difference between Wittgenstein and Russell. Russell put a great emphasis upon sense data, Wittgenstein somewhat less, but anyway, the structure is there, and both of them would say that you have to reduce your knowledge to atomic components. Now, what does this do then to ethics? Well, the realm of ethics cannot be said to be a realm of genuine knowledge. Statements about obligations, statements about goodness and badness, cannot be reduced to momentary sense impressions. Here the logical atomists followed a view that's associated with David Hume, that you cannot deduce an ought from an is. You cannot deduce a statement of obligation from a statement of fact, and they put their own stamp on it. You cannot reduce statements of ethical obligation to statements of sense impressions, and so there you are. Ethics, then, is in a realm that really cannot be coherently spoken of, and really you can't claim to have ethical knowledge. Now, this is a very difficult conclusion to reach, and particularly for a man like Wittgenstein, who throughout his life was engaged in a moral quest, trying to find out what was right and wrong, trying to eliminate the wrongness from his own life, trying to eliminate the consciousness that he had that he was guilty of all kinds of things, trying to criticize his time and his environment and his culture. That was very difficult. Wittgenstein thought that ethics was something terribly important. He felt, in a kind of extra-rational way, he felt that something ought to be said about ethics, and yet he saw, by virtue of his analysis, by virtue of his philosophy, that nothing could be said about ethics, that ethics belongs to the realm of the unsayable, that ethics belongs to the realm of the unknowable. By the way, it's very, very close to Kant's noumenal realm. Now, Wittgenstein really did hedge his bets a little bit here, sort of the way Kant did. Wittgenstein said, now, there are many things like this, things that we want to talk about, but when we examine our language, we find we can't talk about them. What are we going to do about that? Well, he says that we nevertheless have the sense, we nevertheless have the feeling that there's something more, something beyond this world that we analyze and talk about. And he used this phrase to refer to that world, das Mystische, the mystical realm, the mystical realm. Now, technically, the mystical realm cannot even be spoken of. But nevertheless, Wittgenstein felt that he had to do justice to these feelings of moral obligation and so on, that they had to be placed in some area. And so he used this term, das Mystische. And he has the same problems with the mystical that Kant had with the noumenal. At times he talks as though the mystical world does not exist, that it cannot even be spoken of, and therefore it has no reality, and therefore any problems that you have in that area are pseudo-problems, problems that don't even need to be resolved. On the other hand, sometimes he talks as though there really is a realm somewhere where these moral values are to be grounded. Well, he has similar views on religion, and we'll talk about that when we begin next time.